Our format is we have 2 7- to 10-minute speakers, followed by our main 30-minute speaker. Tonight, our first speaker is Mike.
This is a privilege. My topic tonight is the second step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And this is a chance for me to face one of the biggest fears I ever had. In third grade, I was asked to, the little MC guy, I was going to announce the school play, Christmas show, whatever you may call it. I walked in front of that group about bigger than this, a whole whatever school. And I came out like this, and I remember this just pounding in my heart, and I cried and I ran. And I like the fact that I get to, it's only taken me probably 30 or 43, 44 years to get another shot at this. But it's interesting. You do kind of wonder when you get picked for a topic. Thank you, Amy Beth. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 9th, 2008. I have a sponsor. This is my home group. My sponsor is a member of that home group. And I've done my step work, and I'm fearless and thorough to the best of my ability when I do anything in this program. And gosh, I can still remember. I can remember this fear. You know, I can remember just the fear of fear. And it's insane. It's actually funny. It's what got me started in these rooms. I started drinking, I'm going to stick to the step, but I drank a long time, and drinking got rid of this, and I was insane with this fear as long as I can remember. But late in 2000, or early 2002, this fear started to get stronger and stronger, and I view it with insanity, because I was insane. I mean, things started to get insane, and in step two, you're going to come to believe that it's not you. It's not you, and I'll tell you, that is a relief if you're new, and everyone that came here and you're new, that is a huge relief to me, because if it's left up to me, I will not win. I will not succeed. I have a long history of behavior that's kind of insane. I will fail. I will make myself fail. And, through this program and through work, maybe that will change. But then all of a sudden, when you read step two, it's not up to me. And that gave me hope. I mean, that's hope for me. If you know that you don't win, you don't get it done. I'm an alcoholic. I think of just grandiose problems that I have to cure. I have to come through in the clutch. And I better watch this. So I was getting to the insanity of it all when I got invited by a company I work for to look at my drinking, and I started to have anxiety with, it was really nice of them. And I started to struggle with this kind of a fear, this fear. It is just fear. There's really should be no reason. A 2 or 3 year old could get up here, run around, dance, play, wave at you. And my heart was pounding when I walked up there, and Tom, gave me reassurance I would do okay. And I had that where I started to fail at it, and it happened on airplanes. I started to stop. I stopped some flights coming out of Portland. I had to get off. I folded, I lost my mind. I went insane. And I got asked to look at that, and I, because of the fact that I didn't think the fact that maybe I drank 4 or 5 nights a week, 12 to 18 or 22, I forget what I quoted the professional I was seeing at the time. And the company supplied me with a car. They thought that is insane. And they offered, the ability to give me the time to look at my drinking. To get to the step, so I start my program, I start to work this, and I don't drink for a while. And I haven't, I haven't drank since early 08. But I've had this. I have problems with the way I think. I have problems with perceptions. I have problems with little things sober that are unbelievable to me. They're embarrassing because I'm also, a lot of people, if you're an alcoholic like me, you get sober and you have the maturity that is not your age or your gray in your beard or how you look or dress, and you're over there. And I struggle with, I lose my perception. You know, just my perception isn't right. And it's hard to be comfortable with that and go, I'll get better, or look outside of myself. And I had some situations come up. I have career issues. I've had all the issues that a lot of things happen to people. And that same fear came up. And I'd already failed trying to fly. I was going to, you know, fly somewhere for what I thought was a big deal because I was going to dress like this. And I didn't make it, because I left it up to me. And I woke up at midnight and I sweat for about 4 hours and I never even saw the airport. Fast forward about a year, I've done more step work. I started to listen. I pray every morning. I take the actions of someone. And one thing in this that I like about some of the verbiage in the book, not like most of it, but some I like more than others, is this one has actually some things that I could understand and it came to believe. Well, that is really nice wording for a guy like me, because when I got here, I was like, no, you know, guys are in the clutch. You're going to come through under pressure, and you're going to feel really proud about that. It says you're going to come to believe in a power greater than yourself. Well, I ended up having that same situation come up. I was going to go somewhere for what I thought was a very important, job, you know, that job thing. And I woke up once again, one midnight or whatever, but this time I was still losing my mind. I am insane. But I got on my knees and I just tried praying. I did not think that would really work. You know, I actually felt quite silly doing it, tell you the truth, but I've been told to do that. And it's funny, all the things in the program I've been told to do and then I don't do, even though it worked a week before. I mean, how insane, I thought about when I was thinking about this step, and I think, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, I bet you, I remember the first time I wrote a bunch on a four step, made me feel great, didn't write the next day. No, I wasn't going to do that. You know, I wrote a bunch the day before. And in this situation, I did that. I can't say that it was, smooth as silk, but, I went through I tried to turn it over. And obviously the fear doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter what it may be. I have something that comes out that's kind of obvious. You know, you're going to notice the guy stopping the plane and they stop it. You got to take your luggage off. It's hard to miss that. But but with that, It makes me much, to look at everyone, and it goes into a lot of parts of my program, and that everybody, usually if you're like me, you have things that you just fear. You fear it. And I fear it was such a, I like all alcoholics, it's overwhelming. It's unbelievable. And I have history in failing with it without alcohol. Alcohol was the one thing, as we've heard before, it worked. When I drank, I was not frightened, and I could get through things. And that was I practice it there. I practice it, with as many things as I can. I heard Friday night, our group, when it should say, turn your will and your life over to the care of God, and it says many times a day, and it should say many, many, many times a day. And that is another, once again, to me, insanity. The insane things are that I have to hear that. I don't practice it. I don't remember. I just don't remember. Try it again. Do it again. Do it again today. Because I still struggle with a lot of little insanities. All this little crazy stuff that's just, it makes me, kind of who I am. But when I come here and listen to people, it's amazing to me how I feel so odd and unique, no matter how many times I hear that same story, that everyone, how they felt alone and, the odd behavior. And, it's been a challenge, and I've definitely been beaten. A lot of it, like a lot of times I've heard, I've been beaten down to where I accept that and that I will turn that will, and that it's someone greater than me that gets this to happen. Because if this was just me, I wouldn't, at least in my history, I wouldn't do it. I would. I'd be overcome with fear for no reason except I'm just frightened. And I really appreciate this group. And I appreciate, the fact that I get a chance to do this, because really I'm tired of it. I'm tired of it being my responsibility because I'm not that good at it. Thanks.
Our second speaker is Josh.
Hello, everybody. My name's Josh. I'm an alcoholic. And what a treat to be asked to come participate here. See, I've been asked to speak on the 11th step, so I'll do my best to stick to that. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood and praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. It begs the question, why the heck would I do that? At least for a guy like me, it does. And it is because this has become necessary for me because left to my own devices, my brain, and you know, at full throttle, seems to do little but create giant messes and hurt lots of people that are intimately close with me and those that may have the misfortune of being nearby and experience some of that collateral damage. And it delivered me, instead of the happiness that I was so desperately seeking to rest out of this world, it delivered me just misery. And I was so doggone lonely and in pain. And, you know, I hated my life. I really, really hated my life. And that's a sad spot to be. And it was only on the heels of that that I became willing to investigate something as lame as Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had been guided in here many a time, and I couldn't see much past the old crusty folks, you know, talking about their pretty benign drunkalogs, and I just was unwilling, unable to get what was offered here, and it's been offered here for a long time. And there is a fantastic solution for alcoholism here. And if you're newer, and you're wondering what this is, and you're trying to figure this out, please join the rest of us as we continue to try to figure it out as well, and try to figure out how to live happily and usefully and, you know, sober in this world. And it seems to be working for me. Step 11, to seek through prayer and meditation, I tend to view this as the bookend step. You know, it's the mornings and it's the evenings. And this is pretty important for me that, you know, upon awakening, or as close to that as my self-centered brain is willing to allow, that I ask God to arrest this thing that's been trying to kill me for so long before it gets so far away that the reeling back in process becomes more than I'm willing to work through. And ask God to stop all this nonsense in my head. And there are a number of wonderful ways that have been suggested to me that I try to do this. You know, they talk about in we agnostics that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God, but it's been obscured by pomp, by calamity, by worship of other things. This suggests to me my best hope is to try to clear away the stuff that stands in the way of this conscious contact. So that is what I seek. You know, God, help me to remove my fear, dishonesty, self-seeking, self-centeredness, whatever it may be that is blocking me from you and blocking me from being able to be useful to those around me. I am a simpleton. I know this is going to shock a lot of you. I'm a simple guy. So I enjoy a nice little visualization. It has become clear to me that some of the primary things that I seek to quiet, okay, before I can hear those intuitive thoughts, before I can actually hope to be inspired, are things like these God-given instincts that I have warped and twisted beyond their intended purpose. And one of the simple ways that a guy like me can do this is I view this little conference table in my head with the committee of idiots. My pride, my fear, self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal, sex relations, they're sitting around yelling at me. You know, they all want to be recognized right now. We got stuff to say. This is loud. This is important. And that is sort of the, you know, the chatter upstairs. And if I can, it's become clear I'm not going to outrun these. These are God-given instincts. They actually can serve a useful purpose. So if I can actually recognize them. Pride, what is it? Okay, Thanks. Yep. Have a seat. Next. Pocketbook. Oh, there's not enough money. You know, we're going to be broke. We're going to be on the streets again. Great. Thanks, pocketbook. Got it. Have a seat. And I literally can, this simply, can go around this table and recognize these guys, give them a hug, and ask them to have a seat. And there are certainly those times that it is actually a little stronger message that I will offer these guys. Enough. You know, can I get 5 minutes? Thanks. And to quiet that enough, one of the vital purposes that this morning activity serves is, at least as recently as this morning, I have a very real experience of what calm, quiet, peaceful, and okay feels like. I was just there this morning. 20 minutes later, when I want to lay into the horn and plaster my finger to the window, I can, whoa, we have become agitated. You know, this is not where we started. And so to have a recent frame of reference as to what balanced and grounded feels like, they tell me many times throughout each day, you know, thy will, not mine, be done. So this is available to me all the time. And the word conscious seems to indicate to me waking. This is a waking, present, active, deliberate contact with God that I'm seeking to establish and maintain here. So although they are bookend activities to me, I don't typically conclude this meditation and prayer in the morning in any formal, like, we're all done fashion. I tend to ask, you know, please help me maintain this throughout the day or whatever that is and move forward. Because that is what I'm seeking, is to be inviting God into all my affairs as I move forward. Throughout the day, many times when agitated or doubtful, this is certainly the greatest objection I have to the instructions in Alcoholics Anonymous is pause when agitated or doubtful. I don't slow down. I don't pause. I upshift. You know, you guys don't get it. If you'll just shut up for a minute, let me explain what I'm trying to tell you. Let me work a little harder and force this square peg into this round hole. Ouch. It hurts me. It hurts others. And it's when I have ceased to acknowledge these unbalancing things that place me in these conflicts that I've hurt somebody. And now I owe an apology, and hopefully an apology and an amendment of the behavior can be enough. It's a tough deal for me to try to maintain that. But I do try. At the end of the day, I get to cast up, take another look at this. They tell me when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. I do this pen to paper. Honestly, I average probably 4 out of 7 nights a week. I will tell you, leading up to this event, I was 7 for 7. All right. This is a vitally important exercise as well. And I don't want to do it. And I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. My ego wants me out of AA, so I refuse to sometimes. So I continue to try to. I have pads of paper and pens all over the frickin' house. There is no excuse for me not to engage this activity. This can be as simple as a matchbook inventory and a prayer and meditation. It doesn't have to be some exhaustive, you know, lengthy hour-long survey. But there are very specific questions offered there for me. As I'm seeking to try to become useful, I have got to get the self-centered stuff quiet enough that I can hopefully be inspired and try to learn to be of service to others. If I can err in favor of being of service, I have yet to cast up that deal at the end of the day and regret that I was of too great a service today. I was just too helpful. I was not selfish enough today. It has yet to happen. For the newer people, there is a lot of counterintuitive stuff that is asked of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't want to do it. I will tell you, my insistence on understanding the things that we do here is my greatest barrier to acceptance. You don't have to like it. You don't have to understand it. You just got to do it. That's been my experience. And once I do it, it seems to work quite well. All of it together delivers this relief and this feeling of being okay. I'm basically aligning my activities with some of the fundamental laws of the universe. I've been swimming upstream for a long time, and if I can try to align myself with some of these fundamental laws. Like if I go out there and help God's kids, I will actually, as a byproduct, experience some level of happiness and peace out of that. That is not the guy who got here. I was out to take what I thought I needed that was going to make me okay. And it hurt, and it hurt, and it hurt. And now, okay, fine, I'll try to give just a little bit. And it works really well, and I get that relief. That's more than enough out of me. Thanks.
Our main speaker tonight is Lowell.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Lowell. And I feel kind of like I want to cry and run away, but it'd be an encore to Mike. My sobriety date is 12/10/89, and by the time I get done with this, you may want to debate me on that, but I'm going to go ahead anyway. I'm an alcoholic because I'm mentally and bodily, physically different from my fellows. You know, when I consume alcohol, I can't control how much, but that is also my solution. You know, when I was growing up, I felt like I was different from other people. I felt like I didn't fit in. I had a lot of problems, problems that didn't make me alcoholic. I was dyslexic, I was left-handed, I was adopted. I had all these excuses that I could use to justify my behavior, and I did. I learned that from my parents, from the school. They gave me special dispensation, put me in special classes. I belonged in a short bus. But none of that made me an alcoholic. It just made me feel uncomfortable about who I was. And, you know, and was something I couldn't avoid. I can remember in elementary school wishing I could go back in time and start over because I'd do it better next time, I swear, you know. And I had a lot of stuff that I should have done over. You know, I got kicked out of preschool for bringing a kid in the sandbox. I got kicked. There was a teacher's pet in kindergarten who brought in a show-and-tell shirt, which offended me because he took my attention. So I finger-painted on that. You know, it doesn't make me an alcoholic. I got kicked out of Cub Scouts. You know, it seemed like where groups of other people congregated together, they asked me to leave. And, you know, I found ways later on to buy my way in, so they had to keep me around. But, you know, initially, I didn't fit in, and I justified that in my mind to act out and have bad behavior. I was resentful, I was angry, you know, and I needed a drink a long time before I picked one up. Now, the first time I picked up a drink, it wasn't really the solution that it ended up coming to be. You know, the first time I drank, I was at a friend's house. His parents had owned a restaurant that had burned down. There was some booze. We grabbed it. We drank it. We were dancing around just being goofy kids. I lit a fire in the backyard, as most kids would do. And the next-door neighbor, unfortunately for me, was a junior cadet of some sort with a badge, and he called the police. He made a citizen's arrest on me. I was 9. It was, I'm sure it was his crowning glory to that point. The police came, they took me to my parents' house, they explained what a bad child I'd been. Nobody knew I was drinking. It was, you know, it wasn't a drinking problem. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had an arson problem. You know, and I could justify that. I didn't pick up and just start drinking as much as I could get my hands on. I had a couple of ouzos, maybe at a couple of Greek festivals, and you know, that really was about it. I moved from New Jersey to Beaverton, Oregon. And it was a pretty big leap for me. I had a bad accent. I talked like wook and doog, and you know, and you know, I knew I wasn't going to fit in. I never did. So what the hell? I came in guns ablaze, and I told everybody about the gang I'd been in New York. I wasn't in a gang. I wasn't even in New York. You know, I was in New Jersey. Come on. And you know, I tried to impress people with all this BS that I thought would make me okay, would make me the center of attention, and make me fit in. And it didn't. I got in my first fights before I ever got a friend. You know, I played soccer my whole adolescence and my whole elementary school years. You know, I was drummed off of the soccer field. You know, I was duking it out with the guys on my team. You know, and once again, I didn't fit in. But this time when I found alcohol, I found a solution. I found a group of guys that drank in a way that I hadn't experienced before. It wasn't a silly little kid having a couple beers and being goofy. These guys were serious. And I joined right in with them, and I found that solution. You know, I was scared to death of what you thought of me. I'd walk down the halls in school. I knew I was different. I knew I stuck out like a sore thumb. I hated what you thought about me, and I hated you for it. I was balled up with resentments. I was balled up with fear. I didn't know how to deal with it. And when I hung out with these guys, none of it mattered. And when I was drunk, it didn't matter what you thought of me. In fact, I was fine with whatever you thought of me. And, you know, for that matter, I'd give you a double dose of me. Bring it. I really didn't care. You know, that behavior got me in a lot of trouble. I ended up, by the time I was 14, I was locked up in juvenile hall. I was made a ward of the court. You know, I went through a lot of really troubled times. I destroyed the trust of my family. You know, my parents hid the good silver and locked up all their expensive belongings because they didn't know what was going to happen with me. You know, they'd had me made, I was adopted at birth. They tried to give me back at 14. The guys at the adoption place, the court said, you know what, he's damaged goods. You signed a waiver when you bought him. Sorry, you're on your own. They absolved them of responsibility for my actions, but they made me stay at their house, which was unfortunate for them. But, you know, through my experience with my interactions with the law, I was put into a position where if I didn't do specific things, then I was going to go back and spend a lot of time locked up. And I didn't want to do that. And while I'd been in there, I'd gotten beat up pretty badly by a guard, and I was scared to death of it. So I did something to change. I learned how to tell you, instead of saying screw you to your face, I learned how to tell you what you wanted to hear and say screw you in my mind. You know, I learned how to con, I learned how to manipulate so that I didn't have to do the things that were so uncomfortable for me. I played the game, I learned the messages I was supposed to say. I didn't do a whole lot to change my behaviors, and I certainly didn't change my drinking. But I changed how I interacted with other people. You know, I found some limited success with that. You know, I controlled and manipulated to get my own way and found, you know, at least a way that I could pass through life. I still continued, you know, with my drinking and, you know, I found a place where I could fit in a little bit better, where my drinking was okay. I started bouncing in bars. I started working backstage at shows. And, you know, all of a sudden I started having a reason why I was a big shot. You know, I left after work one night. I was at a little club called Mary's downtown. And I walked out of there, just a couple beers, that was all. Just a couple beers. Walked out of there, some guy asked me for spare change, a homeless guy, and I told him no. You know, don't you know who I think I am? And I wanted to show him. I got on my motorcycle and I took off on a wheelie with my buddy on the back and leaned into Broadway there and misjudged the four lanes that I had to land back on the ground and slammed right into a parked Cadillac on the other side of the street. I went through the side window over the top of the thing, ended up in the hospital in a lot of pain. The nurse told me, she was just a sweetheart. She told me, just tell them how much pain you're in. I did, and they gave me a bunch of morphine. They sent me home with a jar of Percocets. Now, a normal person, after having an experience like that, would go home and probably sober up and think, you know, that was a bad night. Not me. I went home and continued partying. You know, I'm the kind of guy, I got a DUI one night. I wrecked my car, got a DUI, got arrested. They let me sober up in the cell and then sent me home on my own recognizance. So what did I do? I went home, got another vehicle, went back to the party and got arrested again. You know, that's the kind of alcoholic I am. You know, absurd and tragic things. You look that up on Wikipedia, it shows my picture. I went home and I just continued partying. You know, I got paranoid. I got, you know, to the place that it describes on the first page of A Vision for You, that dark morass of loneliness spreading out around us. You know, the four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And I decided, you know what, I was done. I got done with all the partying. I got so paranoid, I heard a knock on the door, which was really there, one of the few things in my mind that was. And I thought, uh-oh, it's the police coming to get me. And then the phone rang, and I knew what that was. It was the cops coming to calling to say, we're at your front door, come let us in, or we're going to break it down. So I went to the living room, fully expecting to see the door shattering in. It wasn't the police at all. It was the gas man turning off the gas. But once again, I'd reacted to what was in my mind instead of what was really going on and put myself in a bad position. You know, I got done partying. I hadn't shown up for work for a couple days. I decided, you know what, I can't keep doing this. I was desperate. I was lonely. I'd had enough. All my great plans weren't working out. You know, all the conning and manipulating wasn't getting me where I wanted to be. So I just ate that jar of Percocets and I laid down to die. Now, somebody came into my job and found out I wasn't there. They asked them to go check on me. They did. They found me gurgling and unconscious. They took me to St. Vincent's Hospital, where I woke up in 5-point restraint, tied down, arms, legs, and head with a mask over my mouth. And I woke up. I was in a place of just complete befuddlement. I had no idea. I was bewildered. I had no idea where I was. All I knew is I was going to throw up in this mask and die. I made enough noise that they got that thing off of me before I started puking, and it just puked out black charcoal. I puked it up for a day and came out both ends. It was not pleasant. I came out of that state of befuddlement and that place of desperation. And in the time it took them to keep me in intensive care for a day before they took me to the psych ward, I had a new plan. I always had a plan. I had a great plan. I was going to make it all work out. I knew who I was going to tap to get the money to pay. I had to pay off the guy that I owed the money to. You know, I had a plan. I got up to the psych ward. They locked me up in there. The psychiatrist came and said, okay, it's time for basket weaving, or it might have been moccasin making. I don't remember. Or it might have been group therapy, but I wasn't going to participate in any of it. I told the guy, he said, you've got me locked up here. I can't leave. But you know what? I'm not going to participate. I don't have a problem. I just had a bad day. I'd had a lot of bad days. That was an exceptionally bad day. But nonetheless, I wasn't willing to ask for any help. I wasn't willing to accept what they had to offer. You know, my plan was better than what they had to offer. I threw myself into working and decided, you know what? If I could just be a success at work, then everything would be okay. I went out, I toured with bands, I went all over the world, and, you know, I'd call home and tell, hey, Mom, Dad, I'm in such and such a place, and, oh, isn't that great, son, we're so proud of you. But on the inside, I just wanted to kill myself. It didn't matter if I was in Kuala Lumpur, I just wanted to jump off the top of the hotel and end the insanity, you know, and I didn't know how to get off. I didn't know how to get out of the rat race that I was in, that endless cycle of wanting to be normal, wanting to be okay, not wanting to drink again, and not being able to stop myself. Just having a random thought, seeing a drink, people around me always drinking and just picking it up and not knowing where it was going to end. Not knowing if I was going to end up in jail, not knowing where I was going to fall asleep, pass out, come to, not know what was going to happen. You know, that cycle had gotten pretty ugly and pretty old. The paranoia was constant. I'd get to places that were so uncomfortable. The only way that I could survive them was because I could justify that nobody was with me and seeing it, that it didn't really happen. You don't know about it, so I'm okay. And I'd keep this facade up like everything was okay. But on the inside, it wasn't. I ended a tour in New York, and I grabbed a truck and drove to Detroit. On the way to Detroit, I drank a bunch, and by the time I got there, I was insane again. You know, I was by myself. I was paranoid, driving around trying to shake people off of the back of this truck. I could hear the pop rivets popping as they were trying to pry their way in. And I don't know if anybody knows about anything about pop rivets, but you can't pry them open. You got to have a chisel. But I'm insane. I think that they're coming to get me. I'm trying to shake them off. You know, I end up in the back of the truck, just in a place of just absolute despair again. You know, nothing I've done has worked out. I'm uncomfortable. I don't know what to do. I want to die, but I can't kill myself. You know, there's nothing back there. Nobody was going to pass me in a gun and say, here you go. I got down on my knees, and I just said, God, if there's a hell on earth, I'm in it. And just show me a way out. You know, and I really genuinely meant that. Probably for the first time ever, I wanted help. I wanted to change. I couldn't live the way I was living. So I came home, and I was done fooling around. I was going to go find a way to get sober. So I went down to Eugene to visit a friend from Portland. Went down to Eugene to visit him and find out how he'd gotten sober. He'd been sober for a year, and I knew he'd gone through treatment. I wanted to find out how he did it. I was feeling pretty good. You know, this is it. I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to address my problem. And then the thought came, you know what, why don't we stop off and get a couple beers on the way down to Eugene? Hey, sure, great idea. So we stopped off and got a couple of beers and stopped off again. And by the time I saw the guy, he was already done with his job. It was 2 a.m. I walked up to talk to him about how he got sober, and I was so drunk he didn't even talk to me. He walked right by me, got in a cab, and went. That was my great attempt at getting sober. You know, I came back, I started looking for a treatment center, you know, looking for what I needed to do. I called my parents, asked them if I could come stay for a couple of days, which I'll tell you now, I ended up there for 3.5 years. But I thought, you know, I'd go find a quick treatment center and take the cure, get it taken care of. Went to a couple of AA meetings, didn't understand what was going on there. I went to treatment and borrowed money from my parents to do it, told them I had a problem. I go in there, I've now borrowed money to go, and I won't do what they tell me to do. They tell me I have to write in a notebook. I said, I'm not going to write in a notebook. I don't write very well. How about if I type in a computer? Well, that's really not an option. You need to do it like everybody else. So, well, look, I'm left-handed. I have a tough time with writing. How about if I start in the back of the book and I work forward? I don't want to have to write over that spiral binding. You know, it's inconvenient for me. I know this is a matter of life and death, but if you could do it my way, I'd appreciate it. And the guy says, you know what? What are you terminally effing unique? You know, you can't do it. You're going to do it like everybody else. So I acquiesced and started doing it his way because I didn't see an alternative. The guy told me, though, after my behaviors, that I was not probably going to stay sober. He told me in front of the group at a group level that I was a polydrug user from an early age displaying sociopathic tendencies and that people like me don't get sober. Might as well not even bother trying, he said. What he meant by that was I was so full of crap that I couldn't even see what was going on. You know, I believed a complete set of lies. You know, I was emotionally disconnected from my life because I had to be. I couldn't live the way I was living and feel what was going on. You know, it wouldn't have worked. I had to be able to justify that you were my problem and that all these things that had happened to me in my past were the reasons why I was the way I was. I couldn't take responsibility for it. There was no way. I got out of treatment. I did a fifth step in there, and I read it to a counselor, and he kept looking at his watch. You know, he was in a rush, in a big hurry. Here I am, I'm sharing all this stuff and you know, expecting, you know, some kind of result. I don't know what. You know, I want my $2,800 worth. Come on, cough it up. Well, that's very thorough. Thank you. That was probably the most thorough four-step. What he meant was that was the longest four-step I've ever heard. Thank you. I got to go. So I got out of there, and I felt almost no relief. I felt comfortable there. I was in a safe environment. I learned a little bit about synapses firing and some of the clinical terminology that went along with treatment, but that wasn't going to keep me sober. You know, I got out of there, and the way I felt inside myself, that discomfort, that thinking in my mind that I wish I was anybody other than me, I wish I was anywhere other than where I am, was there just as badly as it had been when I went in there. And I didn't have alcohol to get rid of it. I got out at my first meeting. I grabbed a guy and asked him to be my sponsor. I didn't ask the coolest guy in the room. I didn't know what he drove. I didn't know if he had a cool car, a bad car. I didn't know anything except for the way he spoke and the confidence that he shared when he just was there in that room, let me know that there was something going on with him. I didn't check out his credentials, his pedigree, who his sponsor had been, where he spoke, what he'd done. I just was desperate and wanted help. And I thought he could help me. He told me no, because he saw exactly what the treatment center counselor had probably seen. But I forced him to become my sponsor. He had like 23, 24 years at the time. He didn't need a guy with 60 days who had just come out of treatment thinking that he had something to share. He really didn't, you know. But he acquiesced. He said, come on over to my house Wednesday at 6. I got there at 5:45. I came to his door, and he said, oh, you did make it. Come on in, but don't touch anything and don't talk to my wife. Given my history, I felt like that was probably a pretty reasonable request. But I went into the back room, and it's a nice house in Bellevue, Washington. You know, there were nice cars in the garage. And I walked through his house and into his back room, and he sat down and started telling me about feeling the way I'd felt when I ate that jar of Percocets. He talked to me about being in a place of desperation. He lived in bushes. He had wine sores that wouldn't heal. He couldn't control his bowels. He had the same type of humiliation that I'd suffered in my life. He had the same kind of emptiness on the inside that had driven me to the brink of insanity and to drinking to the point of excess. You know, he talked about the same feelings I had. He talked about being in the same place that I was. And I could see from the way he acted and the way he treated me and the way he lived that he didn't live like that. And it gave me hope. He told me, point blank, you don't have to worry about work. You don't have to worry about all those things, the right girlfriend, the right car, you don't have to worry about that stuff. If you're willing to practice these principles, the steps in your life, the rest of that stuff's going to take care of itself. I wanted to continue to do the life that I'd done, so I continued doing what I'd been doing for a living. And you know, I got into a little altercation at a bar up in Seattle. I'd moved up there to go to treatment. I had to visit my parents for a couple days to get a treatment center. And in this bar, I got into an altercation with a guy. And he pushed my buttons, and I wanted to headbutt him, I wanted to punch him, I wanted to do something. But I'd learned all these new catchphrases in treatment, so I didn't do that. I went to my home group, and I shared all my catchphrases. I'm living a different way. You know, my life has really changed. I'm a different person as a result of being sober. I wasn't sober, I just wasn't drinking. You know, I had 68 days or some great amount of time without a drink. And I got done with my share, and we got done with the meeting, and everybody's breaking up and leaving. I'm in the bathroom and thinking, you know what? I'm doing pretty good. I turn around, and there's two guys from my home group, Wendell and Paul. And I'm like, hi, guys. They're in the bathroom with me. I'm turning around from the urinal, and they say, you know what? We just thought you might want to know that we think you're full of shit. Really? I'm pretty sure I was doing pretty well. And they told me, you know, you need to figure out why you're here. Because you're either here to get sober, and if you are, then you better get busy. And if you're not, you're not going to stick around. If you think you're a big shot, you're not. And that really cut me to the core. You know, I wanted this thing, and I wanted it bad. I went into the place that I was working, and I told them I was done. I wasn't going to do anything except work the steps and work with a sponsor for the next year. I took a temp job putting lumber through a saw. I started doing my four-step. I started writing down all the resentments the way I perceived them, which was pretty easy. I knew everything everybody had ever done to me. I kept a catalog of what you had done to me because that's why I was the way I was. If you would just do it the way I wanted, if you would just allow me to be who I need to be, everything would be okay. And I got all that stuff down. And I tell you, when I was writing it, I was pretty disgusted by what I saw. And I only saw the tip of the iceberg. You know, I got myself so wound up, I'm shoving wood through the saw so fast, the saw is like smoking. They're coming out of the office to look and see what's going on. I'm thinking they're coming out to fire me, and they're thinking, that guy's going to burn up the machine. I'm going nuts. I'm going outside behind the building, throwing up. I had myself worked into a frenzy. You know, that four-step, I did not want to drink. I didn't want to live the way I'd lived. I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. I wanted that thing to work. I got together with my sponsor to do my fifth step, and he pointed out that out of the four columns that the book described, I'd gotten the three that were in the graphic representation pretty right, but I'd missed the part that was in writing because I'm not big on words, I'm bigger on pictures. And he pointed out I'd neatly evaded that whole my part. As I really, to be honest with you, I didn't see my part. I was too busy seeing your part, you know, and he helped me. I'd like to say gently, but that probably would be a misrepresentation of the process. He helped me to see what my part was. He helped me to see my motives and how the outside world had seen me. And when I got done with that, if I thought I was disgusted with my fourth step, I was really disgusted by the time I was done with my fifth step. Now, that may not be your experience, but for me, it was like I'd been introduced to myself for the first time. It's like I just met a guy that I didn't even know. And I saw that, and I didn't want that anymore. You know, I had an opportunity to go make amends after going home for an hour and doing what was required out of the book, and I wanted to make those amends. It wasn't comfortable, I didn't enjoy it, and I took several rewrites because I'd want to go in there and make people like me and get back into their lives. No, I had to be an accurate reporter, report accurately about what I'd done, the damage that I'd caused, and be willing to repair that damage. I went back and I made amends to my family. I made amends to my grandparents, who years before my grandfather had a heart attack. I wanted to go and show him I wasn't a bad guy, so I took a bus up and did yard work in their yard all day. They had to go to a doctor's appointment halfway through the day, so the other grandparents came over. Didn't really seem like a big deal to me, but I found out later they were there to guard the house. Thanks for showing us what a great guy you are, but don't come in the house. Kind of like my sponsor. Don't touch anything while you're here. And, you know, when I found that out, it hurt me to know that that's the way they thought of me, but what choice did they have? I made amends to my family, I made amends to them. I made amends to a gal that I'd been with for years, you know, and when I say be with, it was when it was convenient for me. I'd take just indiscriminately from her in so many ways. When I went back to make amends, I was overwhelmed with emotion. You know, my sponsor said at the end of my fifth step that I was pretty much amoral. They'd already called me a sociopath. They didn't. They said I had tendencies, but close enough, in treatment, and I bawled. I made my amends to her, and I knew how much I'd hurt her and how much damage I'd done. And she was just one of hundreds of people in my life that had come in contact with me and been burned by my behavior. You know, and I could see what I'd done, and I hated it, and I hated myself, and I wanted more than anything to be able to make that right. There's amends that I couldn't make right, but I would if I was able to. You know, I've gone back and cleared up as much as I physically can. I went back to a former employer that I'd wrecked their van, I'd ruined a couple of events, I'd been a catastrophe there, you know. And I didn't look for a specific outcome, I just tried to practice these principles in my life, you know. And as a result of that, my life started unfolding in front of me. I stayed at my parents' house for 3.5 years, I took temp jobs, I worked doing labor work for the next 3 years, you know, but slowly my life came back to me. I went to things unfolded in front of me in ways that I couldn't have imagined. That employer that I made amends to, I ended up going back to work for him. I ended up running that company. I ended up overseeing and being in a bar for 12 years. You know, I ended up doing things that I couldn't have imagined doing in my drinking days, and I couldn't imagine doing sober. You know, the family that I made amends to, the grandparents that had to guard their house to protect from me, I ended up holding my grandmother's hand while my grandfather passed. I ended up being there with my other grandfather when he passed. I ended up being able to participate on life on a level that I couldn't have participated on prior to getting sober. You know, my life has really been a miracle as a result of this program. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? And I'd like to say that everything went along swimmingly and was beautiful, but it wasn't. You know, things happened that were so unbelievably great that I started focusing on that, working 20 hours a day, you know, focused on what I had to amass, that pocketbook, you know, you got to get more. You know, at 11 years of sobriety, my life was unfolding in front of me in ways that were just unbelievable. By 15 years of sobriety, I wanted to blow my head off. I was stressed out. I was completely beside myself. I wasn't working with a sponsor. I disengaged myself from my first sponsor, Taylor, who'd saved my life. The man, the only thing he ever asked me to do was to be willing to give back the time he'd given to me, and he gave me unbridled amounts of time. You know, I got to the point where I literally drove out to go commit suicide. I'd called him. I'd called a couple guys and then just decided, you know, like the night that I'd eaten the jar of Percocets, I'm done. You know, I can't keep doing this anymore. I'm sober. I'm uncomfortable. I don't know what to do. You know, when I got sober, I went and saw a doctor. They told me I was depressed. They wanted to give me Prozac. When I was a little kid, they wanted to give me Ritalin. You know, I couldn't see a solution. You know, I couldn't see what had gotten me sober and gotten me, you know, it tells me in the book that if I straighten out spiritually, mental and physical well-being will follow. But I couldn't see that. You know, I got through that episode. I hadn't slept for like 3-4 days. I hadn't eaten for 3 or 4 days. You know, I literally was going insane. In sobriety, not a drink, not a drug, nothing. You know, and I didn't have a solution. I wasn't engaged in the fellowship. I didn't have a sponsor that was actively sponsoring me. The guys that I was sponsoring, I was checking in with periodically at best. You know, and I refocused. I came up with a plan. I'm going to focus on this part of my work and that. I'm going to bring a couple people to work on these projects. I'm going to do this and that. I had it all figured out, I thought. I wrote a letter to an employer excoriating that employer for some of their behavior and how it had affected me. And that employer forwarded it to one of their partners who was actually a member of this fellowship. And he said, you know what, Lowell? I think you might want to look at this because it looks like untreated alcoholism to me. I said, really? So I flew down to Laguna Beach where he lived, and I spent some time with him, and I looked at it, and I started to see where my behavior had taken me back to. I made amends while I was there, but more importantly, I fell back in love with Alcoholics Anonymous while I was there. I saw a fellowship there that I envied, that I loved, and something that I knew was missing from my life. And I went and I met a guy by the name of John Ackerland, and he said, come on over to my house, we'll talk. I walked over into his house. I walked through his door. He didn't tell me not to touch anything or not to talk to his wife, but he gave me a card that had Chris Clark's number on it. A guy in Laguna, California gave me a card for a guy up here where I couldn't find a meeting where I fit in. You know, I couldn't find a meeting that talked about what my home group had talked about, practicing principles and all their affairs. You know, I got connected with Chris. I got connected with this meeting and really just made this my primary focus. My primary purpose, going to meetings, sponsoring guys, taking meetings into institutions, because that saved my life once, and in sobriety, it saved my life again. You know, I have most of the time, I can't say all the time, most of the time, I have a pretty good sense of ease and comfort. I'm pretty comfortable with who I am, and I don't have to drink to get that way. But even in sobriety, you know, I can get to that place where I'm insane. I have a mental disease that tells me that things that are going on are reality, and I have to respond to them. And I'm completely dead wrong. I'll tell you a quick story, then I'll close. I ordered a piece of hardware, to give you an example of insanity. And it was just a little add-on to our front door. And we went through the process, we ordered it, and it didn't come in. So I went in a couple times and said, hey, what's going on with that thing? Oh, yeah, it's coming, it's ready. We're going to have it over to you in no time. Okay, great. And then I call back a couple weeks later. Oh, yeah, sure, let's check on that. We'll fax them. And then I get a call from the guy, this clerk. And he says, hey, Janitor Lowell, we've got your part ready. We need you to call and give us this information. You need to fax us this, fax us that. I'm like, this has been going on for 6 months. Why are you calling me now, asking me for more information? And why in the heck are you, a clerk, calling me a janitor? And I just, you know, it kind of sat wrong with me. It didn't matter what I do for a living. It's none of his business what I do for a living. And why is he trying to put me down with that, you know? So I sent him off the information he needed. I got him taken care of, and it just kind of stuck in my craw, and it ate at me. You know, I was sitting down one Saturday afternoon. I was telling my wife, Janet, I said, honey, you know, this guy was such a jerk. You know, he calls me up and calls me a janitor. What right does he have? She says, are you sure he called you a janitor? Absolutely. He left it on my voicemail, Janitor Lowell. And Janet says to me, Lowell, do you think maybe he was saying Janet or Lowell? And then it gets worse. She says, you weren't thinking of me at all. How would I think about you? I've got me to think about. But if I don't have outside input, what goes on inside my head is going to take me out. And this fellowship and the things that are provided by it are what keep me sane. And I appreciate you allowing me to have 30 minutes of your time to share my insanity. Thanks.